Yes, but I go by Annie. We will use the full dragon tongue in this class, I think, Antigone. A very unusual name for a Highlander. And then we have Power Sir Eater.
Power lifts his fingers to indicate his presence. Tyndale smiles.
Welcome. I'll be glad to tell your father that I've finally got you as my student. Corsa Morana?
Cor nods. Tyndale's eyes slide to the only remaining new student, and he stills.
Leo? Dragon's bloody sparkfire.
Lee's eyes widen for a fraction of an instant.
Lee, he says. Lee Sir Pallor.
Tyndale twitches. He hastens to correct himself.
Of course, my mistake.
Leo. The unfamiliar name reverberates in my ears with the shock of an unexpected obscenity. I want to hide it away and never hear it again. As Tyndale turns from us, a few students glance at one another, exchanging looks of perturbed amusement. As if they're wondering how Tyndale could forget the name of a guardian in the Fourth Order. Lee has sunk low in his seat beside me.
I trust the four of you received the assignment I sent along with your primers. Good. Then let's get started. Volunteers to read the dragon tongue?
The class is midway through translating the Aurelian Cycle, the epic poem considered the foundational text of dragon tongue literature. Hannah volunteers and begins to read. Her dragon tongue is without accent, the mark of a native speaker. I register in surprise that someone with such a background would ever think of me as amazing. But then, as she begins to read about Uriel Sir Aron, leading his people into exile from the destruction of the sunbright island of Old Araeos, Lee closes his eyes and grips the sides of his desk. It's hard to know whether the sight of his face or the sound of the words I'm listening to provokes my rising sorrow. Even if some of the words escape me, the tragedy of the line is clear enough, and still piercing.
Antigone, why don't you translate first?
I practically jump. Tyndale is smiling in a way that makes me wonder whether I'm imagining the tone of challenge in his voice. I flip open my notebook, conscious of being watched by a classroom of strangers, and look down at my homework. The sight of my translation calms me at once. I've triple-checked it. I begin to read, and then, as Lee clears his throat loudly beside me, I remember to raise my voice. The way I've been practicing in empty classrooms, at every spare moment since the Fourth Order tournament. When I'm finished, I look up to find Tyndale staring at me.
Good,
he says. But he doesn't sound pleased so much as surprised.
Did you notice anything interesting about that last line? Any figures of speech that caught your eye?
Hands are going up around the room. Tyndale glances on them, then back at me, giving me a chance. Figures of speech aren't something you learn in conversational dragon tongue classes, but they were listed in the glossary at the back of the primer, and I read that glossary last night. I look down, twisting my hands together beneath my desk. Ascending tricolon, chiasmus with the nouns and adjectives, and an enjambment to the next line. The hands are going down. Tyndale is nodding.
Good, he says again. What about the form of the verb? Anything interesting there?
A historical infinitive.
Well spotted. And its paradigm?
I recite it. Tyndale catches Lotus's eye.
Looks like our poet son has competition.
For the remainder of the class, Tyndale calls on me several more times, and on Power and Cor enough to determine that Power's translations are from memory and that Cor's grasp of the grammar is rudimentary at best. He doesn't call on Lee.
At the end of class, when he dismisses us, he adds, "If you have a minute, Lee."
Lee remains hunched, face downturned, while the rest of us exit the classroom. In the hallway, I hesitate, foreboding coiling in my stomach. Should I wait for Lee? Make sure he's all right after whatever conversation Tyndale wants to have with him? Would he even want that? Would I want that? No, I'm pretty sure. Actually, I'm absolutely certain I wouldn't.
Hey, Antigone!
Hannah Lund stands in front of me, bent to one side to counterweigh her book bag, tucking a stray curl behind her ear. A few of the other girls from class wait for her a little apart from us watching.
Some of us go do homework in the library together after class, if you want to join.
It takes me a second to understand what she's asking. A gold student, an almost certainly patrician gold student, is inviting me to do something with her friends? And nervous to do so, as if she fears my rejecting her? I shift my own book bag higher on my shoulder. She's taller than me. They're all taller than me. Consistently, patrician kids are. I have to look up to meet her uncertain eyes.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Hannah grins. Lee will have to figure out the business with Tyndale on his own. I don't begin to worry about him until he starts missing meals. Absent from dinner that evening. Absent from breakfast the morning afterward. The first time I see him again is in class later in the morning, and the bruises under his eyes have grown so dark that he looks haggard. What did Tyndale say to him? The Fourth Order riders attend our first High Council meeting that afternoon, or at least, it's a first for some of us. I'm pretty sure Lee's been going for over a year already. We listen, take notes, and are told to ask questions later, at class with the First Protector. His class is held in a conference room of his office. Like so many rooms in the inner palace, it overlooks the Firemouth, the cavernous central opening to the dragon's caves that, for the old regime, connected the three families' apartments directly to their dragons, a mere summoning whistle's blow away. On the other side of a wall of rippling glass, a stone balcony that once doubled as a lord's dragon perch looks out over the encircling windows of the inner palace. In other parts of the palace, especially the halls repurposed to public use, the original dragon-born heraldry has been effaced. But here, the stained glass edging the windows in red roses remains, a traditional symbol of Aurelian House. Atreus's own additions to the room are austere, simple wooden furniture, unadorned but well-made, and hard-backed chairs. We rise when he enters.
"Please, be seated," Atreus says. "We will not waste time with formalities in this setting."
We resume our seats, and Atreus takes his own, straightening the collar of a simple tunic that emphasizes his severe, hawk-like features and a grave face weathered by experience. Atreus's monastic lifestyle is almost as legendary as his career. An orphaned patrician, a scholar in Deimos, an advisor to the Triarchy, and finally, the leader of the revolution that brought it down. He's been known to say that Callipolis is his wife, the revolution his child, that the Guardians will be his legacy.
"I have heard nothing but praise of the four of you," Atreus tells us, "and consider it a privilege to take part in the final stages of your training. I intend for our class to cover subjects ranging from the philosophical to the poetic. Both will serve a purpose to you as future statesmen. Theory for the mind, beauty for the soul."
He sets two books on the table in front of him, his own revolutionary manifesto, written the year before the revolution, and the Aurelian cycle, in the original dragon tongue.
But practical matters to start us off. Do you have questions about the High Council meeting?
I raise my hand all the way up. This time, unlike with Perkins, Atreus's eyes do not pass over me.
Antigone?
Lee. There's a certain irony, after years of going unrecognized, to being noticed by your family's old poetry tutor. After the other students are gone, Tyndale walks to the door, looks out in the hall in both directions, and closes it. His footfalls echo in the empty stone-walled classroom. I'm racking my memory for anything about him that points to what he'll want to do with me now, but there's nothing. I was only 6 or 7 the last time I saw him, and he mainly taught my older sisters. You're alive. He says it with unmistakable relief. He stands in front of me, his palms braced on the desk at the front of the row I'm sitting in, and looks at me like I'm some sort of apparition. So he doesn't mean to turn me in. I realize I've been holding my breath for the last minute and exhale. How did you survive? He's switched to dragon tongue. Even as my breathing returns to normal, I feel a twinge of irritation. If he's so happy to see me, so happy to see I survived, why is he risking my safety for a language preference? Anyone could be listening outside the door. They would be more than surprised to hear a Cheapside orphan speaking native-level dragon tongue. Atreus intervened, I say in Kalish. Tyndale's eyes widen. He saved you? I nod. And your family? Did he save any of the others? He's still speaking in dragon tongue, and this question has an urgency to it that surprises me. No. He's still waiting, staring at me. But for a moment, I can't think of anything more to say that I can put into words. It was too late for the others. I try to say the words without thinking about them, but images flash across my mind and empty it. And for one moment, the whole classroom fades away. Tyndale has turned away as if swept by a similar emotion. I'm sorry. I wouldn't usually say, but I suppose there's no reason not to now. He gives a little half-lost laugh. I was in love with your sister. My sister? Which sister? I wonder for a second, then realize who it must have been. As if hearing my thoughts, he adds, Penelope. Her name, her face, everything about her comes flooding back. It's strange to hear her name on another's tongue, as if after years of not speaking about my family to anybody, some part of me had stopped believing that anybody else could have known them. He keeps talking, not like he wants to, but like he can't bring himself to stop. It obviously wasn't something that had a future. I was lowborn, even if I was a scholar, and she was on her way to being betrothed to some Aurelian. I don't remember his name, but I loved her. Dragons, I loved her. Even though I knew she would never love me or be able to have me, I've never loved anyone like I loved her. Penelope was 16 when she died. I had not known about a betrothal. I hadn't thought of her as the sort of being that men fell in love with or married. She had simply been my oldest sister. My beautiful, joyful sister who was always abandoning grown-up conversations to come and play with me. Her hair was dark, like mine, but it was long and wavy and used to fall around her shoulders like two curtains when she crouched to my height. I realize that I'm a year older now than she ever got to be. When I heard what happened on Palace Day, I just... He doesn't finish, just stops. And for me, everything stops too. I sit completely still, feeling the ground beneath me slipping. I lean forward, brace my elbows on the desk, place my head in my hands, and wait for it to stop. Worst of all are the sounds that come with the images. Tyndale is so lost in his own thoughts, I don't even think he notices my response. When he speaks again, his narrative has skipped forward. I let the words wash over me, and slowly the other sounds in my head recede and the images fade. I think I went mad for a little while after it happened, Tyndale is saying, his voice hoarse, cracking a little. Palace Day was one of the most terrible massacres this city has ever seen. Yes, the guilty were punished, but so were countless numbers who were completely innocent, just for being born into a particular family. Atreus punished them, I say, my voice sounding distant in my own ears. Death penalties, life sentences, for the people who... I don't finish. Yes, he locked them up, says Tyndale, almost impatiently, but he still has us celebrate it. Palace Day, a commemoration of the brave beginnings of a new regime. It's a blight, a stain on the new regime that Atreus should never have allowed. When he did, that was when I knew. Knew what? That he would be no better. That in the end, he might even be worse. The Dragon Lords, at least there was nobility in them. Not this cowardly bureaucratic hypocrisy. Tyndale doesn't speak in the tone of someone interested in a more nuanced point of view. An unexpected resentment comes to me. I remember feeling these things, or something like them. I remember the old dream, and the old failure. But I was a child then. Tyndale was an adult. If he was so certain at the time, he could have done something. You could have set off for New Paphos if you'd wanted, if you were so certain the old order was better. I tried, Tyndale says. That stops me short. I prompt him. But? But I was told to wait. That's not the reason I expect. By whom? By people I think you would like to meet. People, Tyndale adds with delicate emphasis, who have been biding their time. The sun is low enough in the sky to send orange rays horizontally across the room, lighting up the desks and Tyndale's silhouette, strewing jewels of colour where it pierces through stained glass. You're talking about New Paphos? The Haurelians? I hear my own scepticism, despite my accelerating pulse. I've read too many bloviating editorials in the People's Paper full of such conspiracy theories. The nationalist sentiment they foment is too easily tracked, a predictable chemical reaction that the Ministry of Propaganda sets off when desired. That's an idle threat. They're powerless. Or so they've led Kallipolis to believe. We look at each other and I say nothing. Though my heart, by now, is pounding. Perkins's words from Diplomacy return to me. We have no idea what they're planning, shrouded in the North Sea's fog. Tyndale asks, does Atreus know who you are? I shake my head. To my surprise, Tyndale smiles. Perfect, he says. You'll be well placed. Well placed for what? But there would only be one what. Would you like to meet them? Tyndale asks. I'm sure they'd like to see you again. I'm sure they've missed you. My throat is tight. Who? Which one survived? Would they even know me? I'm sure they would appreciate your help, Tyndale adds. Lashing rain and dark fog blanket the North Sea. We're drilling by squadron. Chrissa leads the Skyfish drills, Kor the Storm Scourge, and I the Aurelian. My squadron tails one another through the rain, struggling to stay in formation through the poor visibility, and we race to break the surface of the clouds one after another. The blue sky and glaring sunlight are blinding when we burst through the last layer of rain clouds. Palor twitches water from his wings with a snort of satisfaction. I can feel his heaving breaths through the saddle as I yank off my helmet and wipe rain from my eyes. We count off, one by one, as the Aurelian riders breach the cloud cover, soaked and shivering, but with our formation intact. When all are accounted for, Palor and I take a moment to regain our breath. And that's when I notice it. Other dragons on the horizon. At first, I think nothing of it. The squads have divided, and some could have flown farther north than planned. Until I see a gleam of gold. Aurelians. All of my Aurelians just counted off. which means that the ones on the horizon are not in the Kallipolan fleet. And then gleams of other colours, flashes of blue, blotches of darkness. A full fleet with all three breeds. They're approaching, growing larger, their outlines becoming clearer against the sky. The hair on the back of my neck rises. A full fleet, announcing itself. They've been biding their time. With the force of an explosion, my emotions, a mixture of surprise and joy and longing, spill into Palor, who lets out a screeching cry, my feelings erupting from his mouth. Then, as his cry fades, there's noise above the whistling of the wind, Annie shouting, "Everyone, get down!" Her fist forms the signal for those too far to hear her voice. The rest of the squad begins diving back into the cover of the stratus clouds. It occurs to me, distantly through the fog of our spillover, that I've never heard Annie call out orders before, because, as Aurelian squadron leader, that's my job. But I'm transfixed, unable to tear my eyes from the fleet that bears down upon us. What thoughts I can unravel from Palor's are focused on a single point. My people, my family, close.
Max, Deirdre, find Cor and Krissa and tell them to call off their squads. The drills are over. Tell them we have a foreign fleet sighting, possible spark dragons 2 miles north.
And then Annie has reined Ayla round, facing Palor, blocking our sight of the Pythian fleet. She too has pulled off her helmet, and beneath it her face is white, her eyes wide. Her rain-darkened hair is plastered across her forehead, water still trickling down the sides of her face. For the first time, looking at me, she seems frightened.
Lee! Let's go!
Chapter 4. Aletheia. A year had passed since the boy entered the orphanage. Though he and the girl continued to plan for their trip to New Pythos, the idea gradually lost its urgency. He had gotten good at school, better at chores, and the nightmares were coming less often. New Pythos was as far away in his imagination as his family was becoming in his memory. Then, on the first anniversary of his family's murders, there was a parade through the city. The day had been named a national holiday. Palace Day commemorated the turning point in the Red Month, the day the people finally breached the walls of the palace after the dragons had been poisoned. Standing in the main square, the boy had a clear view of the one surviving dragon, brought forth for the final spectacle, and could easily recognize it. His father's dragon had been one of the largest in the old fleet. Aletheia had a coloring unique among storm scourges, red-tipped wings and a red crest. The boy remembered running his hands over her hard scales, laying a hand on the bridge between her great black eyes. Today, the mighty beast was almost unrecognizable. She had long since had the sparker cut from her throat, her wings clipped, and now she was barely more than an exceptionally large, cart-sized beast with fierce jaws. These two had been chained shut. The boy watched the dragon being led up onto the dais, the chains cinched back so her head was forced down. Then the man who had saved him, who now called himself the First Protector, spoke about the things this dragon had done. Villages burned, innocent blood spilled, senseless and undeserved violence suffered by countless hundreds under this dragon, and countless thousands under other dragons for centuries. He said that such times would never come again. But the boy didn't listen. He was watching his father's dragon struggle to breathe. Then he heard a sound to his right and looked down. The girl, standing next to him, was weeping. She did not take her eyes off Aletheia, and tears were streaming down her face. He put his arm around her and pulled her close. He assumed that she was feeling the same sorrow he felt as he watched the once great beast be humiliated. Standing like this, holding the girl, he watched the axe cut off the head of his father's dragon. Out in the yard, later that day, the boy found the girl sitting under one of the few trees, her eyes closed, He thought she was sleeping until she opened them. "You were crying today in the square," he pointed out. He felt compelled to say it, as if he needed some confirmation of the grief that they had, for that moment, shared. He was on the brink of telling her everything. It was time, he had decided. The sight of Alethea's execution had galvanized him. It was time to go, and he was going to bring the girl with him. She looked up at him from where she was sitting and seemed on the verge of speaking, as if she were trying to decide whether or not she wanted to. But slowly, she gathered courage. Her face stiffened, became determined, and she spoke in a low, controlled voice. "That dragon killed my family." Lee.
Annie keeps Ayla close beside Palor during our flight back to Kallipolis. The rest of the squadron follows close behind. In the silence that Annie leaves me, I struggle to extricate from Palor's mind. I'm holding him by the neck, leaning low on the saddle, fighting the desire for his closeness, and Palor only makes it harder. He senses my distress and tries to stay close, struggling to offer me comfort. Meanwhile, the thoughts are buffeting. Tyndale was right, all this time, while I convinced myself that the blustering of their threat was nothing but cheap shots fired by the Ministry of Propaganda for the consumption of gullible class irons. Who were they, those riders who were almost close enough to speak to? Were there other Palace Day survivors? Were they kin? When we're within sight of the palace, Annie speaks. Her words are muffled, her expression hidden beneath her visor. She raises her voice over the pounding rain. "Lee, have you extricated?" The problem of her, of what she knows or doesn't know, is too great a problem for my mind, still fighting free of Palor's, to assess. I've never been the kind of rider who spills over easily, much less the kind that lets it last. This was irregular, and Annie knows it. And she saw what triggered it clearly enough. I grit my teeth. "Nearly. The sighting needs to be reported to the inner palace directly." I realize what she's getting at and balk. The thought of military council, of sitting down before Atreus Athanatos now. Are you going to report me? I would, in a better state, know to swallow the question that gets halfway out before I bite my tongue. But this lost in spillover, enough of a rising note of panic escapes with it. Annie's helmet turns briefly in my direction. She doesn't ask me to finish my question. "It will be irregular if you're not there. Pull yourself together." When Annie tugs at Ayla's reins, breaking away from the rest of the fleet, I follow numbly. The inner palace lies below us, a tower of inward-facing windows encircling the firemouth entrance to the dragon's caves, blurred by rain. Annie stalls after entering it, looking from one Aurelian balcony to the next, uncertain which leads to the first protector's office. I speak for the first time, pointing. "It's that one." Atreus works from apartments that in my childhood belonged to the Aurelian Triarch. I was taught as a child to recognize the balcony that doubled as his dragon's perch. Annie's shoulders stiffen at my knowledge, but she doesn't question it. We land, dismount, and dismiss our dragons. For a moment, Palor resists, the after effects of the spillover still linking us. I lift my helmet, pull him close, and rest my forehead against his dripping, silver-ridged brow before wrenching my mind free. He lets out a whimper at the extricating that makes my fists curl. And then he follows Ayla down into the darkness of the firemouth. As the two dragons are swallowed in the rain-lashed shadows of the cavern, a headache grows with his distance. And then the thoughts return. Alive. Some of them are really alive. And as Tyndale hinted, they have dragons. They have a chance of taking Kallipolis back. I hear the pronoun in my thoughts and test its alternative, the appeal of it humming in my blood. What if not they, but we? I raise my head to find Annie looking at me. Her helmet tucked under her arm, her wet hair plastered on her forehead, her face twisted with an expression I cannot begin to divine. disappointment, disgust, anger. She turns from me, steps forward and hammers on the door built into the glass wall. A second later it opens. A very surprised assistant takes in the sight of us, two drenched teenagers in flame suits standing on a balcony that has no other entrance. "We need to speak to the First Protector and General Holmes immediately," Annie says. The meeting passes in a haze. Annie takes one look at me, then does the talking herself. We sit in the council room with Atreus and General Holmes, the Minister of Defence, at the great oak table usually reserved for members of the High Council. Though I'm familiar with Holmes from rounds, I'm almost certain Annie isn't. Where Atreus is perpetually clean-shaven and modestly dressed, Holmes wears a close, curling brown beard and keeps the many decorations of his uniform well-polished. He made a name for himself in the revolution at Atreus's side, an infusion of low-born vigour in contrast to Atreus's high-minded principles, and the reputation he gained was for ruthlessness. I've always considered it best not to learn the details. Holmes likes me. I've worked with him for years. It's never been relevant. But today, as I look at him and think of dragons from New Pythos, it feels relevant. Far from betraying intimidation in such formidable company, Annie sits up straight and describes the Pythian fleet with precision. She managed to count them while also issuing orders to the squad. In total, she accounted for 5 skyfish, 9 Aurelians, and 7 storm scourges. Too distant to make out their ages. Holmes finally asks, "And after you saw them, did you engage?" He is looking at me, I realize, waiting to hear how I responded as leader of the squadron. I feel a dull flood of panic hit. This is it. This is the end. A single spillover to undo almost 10 years of pretending and reveal me as the potential traitor that I am. But when Annie speaks, it isn't to say that. "Lee told everyone to get below cloud cover and back to Kallipolis." I swing a sideways glance at her in amazement. Covering for me. Annie's covering for me. Pinpricks of pink on her pale cheeks are the only evidence of what this is costing her. After years of being underestimated, written off by the ministry of this country, and by extension the men sitting across from us, Annie has just proved herself competent in a crisis, capable of leadership, and worthy of the kind of promotion she was recently told not to pursue. And she's sweeping her actions under the rug, for my sake. Shouldn't you have turned me in instead? Because surely the kind of visions that have been slithering through my mind are those of someone who deserves to be turned in, not sheltered. Surely these fantasies of triumph and retribution, abandoned since my childhood but now back with all their seductive force, are enough to damn me. Annie meets my gaze and lifts an eyebrow. I clear my throat, and then for reasons I cannot even begin to understand, I hear myself accept her gift and offer the explanation she and Holmes are waiting for. We had no way of knowing whether they had sparked and we were unarmed. Sparked, meaning dragons mature enough to breathe fire rather than ash, as ours are still too young to do.
"Good call, Lee," Holmes says. His deep voice is warm, approving.
Annie swallows hard. I feel sick. Atreus drums his fingers on the table and speaks for the first time.
"It's clear we've made a grave error in overlooking New Pythos," he says. "We were content to dismiss rumours of dragon sightings off the northern coast as idle gossip, useful for our propaganda and nothing more. It appears we have misjudged."
"We should have attacked them years ago," Holmes murmurs, "when their dragons were weak, stormed that godforsaken rock with the full navy, and wiped the rest of those inbred little bastards out. Now it's too late."
Inbred little bastards. The kind of slur I'm usually all but numb to, but today causes my mind to burn, as if fevered with visions of vengeful dragonfire. What if I never had to sit stone-faced through such slurs again? Atreus hums his dissent.
"Let's not jump to conclusions. or dispatch word to our ambassadors on Iskar to seek an audience at the new Pythian embassy immediately. Perhaps Rhadamanthus can be reasoned with. Rhadamanthus Haarelian, the current scion of New Pythos. Atreus turns to an aide sitting at the end of the table. Summon the two fastest skyfish riders, tell them they're needed as messengers. That would be... He looks at me. Chrissa, Dorian, I answer, supplying Duck's rarely used full name. The aide bows and leaves. Once he's gone, Holmes leans forward. You think diplomacy will settle this? He asks Atreus. I am bound to consider it if it might prevent a war. Holmes's face is dark with skepticism. I remember the fleet approaching, the full force of their numbers spread against the sky, and can't help but share it. Those were not the demonstrations of a nation seeking a diplomatic solution. The corridor outside is quiet after our dismissal, its few windows letting in rain-smothered light. For a moment after we've closed the door behind us, Annie and I stand side by side. The foot between us feels like a great distance, and the silence feels loud. The past hour is reverberating within me in flashes, the sight of their fleet, the desperate longing. Annie's voice crying my name and tearing me away. The sound of her voice describing the job I should have done, as if I had done it. And all the while my thoughts straying to dreams of revenge that would mean the betrayal not only of her, but of her people. She turns and walks away. Annie? But I have no idea what I'm about to say to her. And she doesn't turn back.
That dragon killed my family. For a second he stared at her, not understanding. And then he thought he must have misheard. He asked her to say it again, and she did. You're lying, he said. She did not expect this. Her eyes widened. My family was killed by a dragon, she said. Soldiers locked them in the house and our dragon lord set fire to it. How come you're alive then? She blanched. Because he made me watch. He remembered the feeling of an adult's hands on his shoulders, forcing his face toward things he didn't want to see. That doesn't make sense, he spat. She seemed to be struggling to find the words to explain herself. It was clearly the last thing she'd been expecting to do. He said one of us had to watch so they could tell the rest of the village. Her voice was starting to waver. He cut her off because he didn't want to hear her crying. How do you know it was the dragon from the square? Because it was a storm scourge with red on its wings. Then they must have deserved it! He practically shouted at her. Her head went back against the tree behind her as if he had struck her. For a moment, they just stared at each other, her head tilted back, looking at him with bleak disbelief, him staring down at her, feeling his chest rising and falling, and something like hatred coursing through him. She spoke first, her voice very quiet. They were killed because we didn't meet a food quota during the famine. There was no famine, he snapped. She blinked. Excuse me? It was a bunch of lies. Everybody knows that. Exaggerated so people could get away with not paying what they owed. My mother, she said, died during the famine. So did my baby brother, because we didn't have enough food. And we lived on a farm. Her eyes were bright, but she seemed so angry now that she was past crying. She pointed a thumb over her shoulder at the children playing elsewhere in the yard. And in case you haven't noticed, the famine is why most of them are here. She pushed from her knees up, so she slid to her feet with her back still against the tree. Even standing, she was more than a head shorter. She was looking at him as though she'd never seen him before. All the fury and disgust that she had for her tormentors was, for the first time, turned on him. "Stay away from me," she said. Annie.
My feet take me away from Lee with the force of physical repulsion. If I have to spend another moment in his presence, the emotions that have been simmering will turn to a boil. I need space to think, and I need to do it without having to look at those grey eyes and those cheekbones that are just a little too fine and high. Stay away from me. Should I have turned him in? That's the question that locks itself in my mind as I walk away. I'd be a fool to trust him. But all the same, I couldn't bring myself to do it. I don't blame Lee for spilling over, and I don't blame him for the look of longing that transformed his face when he first saw them. It doesn't take a stretch of the imagination to understand what he must have felt. I know the ache of an orphan's loneliness. I know what it is to crave the comfort of kin. All that was natural. I blame Lee for what followed. For listening to me when I told him to turn around, though it seemed to tear him apart. For sitting beside me as I reported a military threat of dragon lords on the horizon to the leaders of Kallipolis, and then hoarsely offering his counsel, for giving me the faintest hope that, maybe, I hadn't just lost him. I blame him for the fact that I still want to trust him. I want it so hard it hurts. And the fact that I just forewent credit in front of Atreus Athanatos and Eamon Holmes for the sake of this fool's hope makes me sick to my stomach. Back in the cloister, I go to the boy's dorm in search of Duck, who's packing. A sealed message has been given to him and Chrissa to bear to the Nupithian ambassador on Iska. The sworn neutral archipelago federation on the northwest edge of the Medean Sea. He and Chrissa have been told to wait until Rhadamanthus's answer is returned. "Please be careful. Ride fast. It'll be fine, Annie," Duck says. "We're heading south anyway." But it doesn't seem like enough after you realize the skies contain dragons other than your own. Two unsparked skyfish is precious little defense against a hostile sky. Somewhere during our conversation, he took my hands in his, and now, though I know I'm supposed to, I don't want to let go. "It's time, Duck." Chrissa has appeared in the doorway of the dorm, her helmet under her shoulder. Her braid is still wet from the rain. We haven't been on the ground long enough since the first sighting for it to dry. She casts an eye on our entwined hands, but makes no comment. "I know." Duck withdraws his hands from mine. Then he clears his throat. "I'm not sure how long we'll be gone, but I wanted to say, midsummer when we get back. You'll come?" He's offering more than an invitation, I realize. He's setting a fixed point on a vanishing horizon, something for me to focus on. The realization nearly brings a lump to my throat. "Yes, I'll come."
"Good.
And make sure you invite Lee." Lee. I think of that silent corridor, standing beside Lee in the rain-thick darkness as he said my name. When I found myself unable to look at him, much less speak to him. The lie comes out, as if of its own accord. "I already asked him. He said no." I haven't asked him. I haven't even brought up the idea. As far as he knows, we're spending midsummer in the cloister together like always. But that's unthinkable now. Duck's eyes narrow as he looks at me. Even Chrissa looks a little surprised.
"Okay then," Duck says. "Just the two of us."
He sounds uncertain, but not displeased. "Just the two of us."
After their fight, the other children resumed the torment they had stopped in his presence. The boy watched them steal the girl's meals, trip her, tear apart her homework before class, so she'd be punished for not doing it. He did nothing. All the while, her words gnawed at him. He tried at first to dismiss them as a child's joke, some kind of willful lie gone too far. He told himself she was little, too little, and had not understood what had happened to her family. But this was not enough. She wasn't much younger than him, and he knew she was smarter. She understood everything. He struggled to comprehend the story she'd told. Even here, he protested. She must have been ignorant of something. Even if there had been a famine of some sort, his father would never have punished his people without good reason. But this was a dead end, too, because he couldn't think of any reason good enough to make a girl watch her family burn to death. He kept trying to reconcile his father and his dragon with a burning house, a family dying, a girl being held and made to watch. He could not think of anything that could have merited it. How could his father have done such a thing? His father had been brave, noble. His dragon made him a leader of men, not just a good man, but a great one. These beliefs, taken for granted before his father's death, were one of the few comforts he had left. Now these comforts were stained. Try as he might, he could no longer think of his father without a sickening sense of doubt. It infected all his memories, even memories of things like dinner with his family and stories before bed were no longer safe. He lost his appetite, stopped sleeping, was unable to focus in class. His thoughts went round and round as he tried to find a way of preserving the father he'd remembered before he learned the girl's story. In the end, after their desperate circling, he arrived at a simple solution. He could go. He had the provisions. He had a plan. He was ready as he ever would be. New Pythos was waiting. He need not succumb to the girl at all. He need not choose. He could simply leave. Annie.
It's beginning to feel like the whole world is tearing apart, and that part of what I'm losing is Lee. Instead of dinner and homework, I sit in on meeting after meeting, alongside Lee, Kor, and Power in the Inner Palace. At a debriefing Holmes holds for the entire Kor, we're given a new patrol schedule for the northern coast of Kallipolis and told that our training will narrow in focus to air combat exclusively and not the kind performed in tournaments. Meanwhile, the tournaments themselves have taken on a sinister new significance. In times of peace, the titles of First Rider and Alternus are little more than honorifics, Holmes tells us. But now, we need to be prepared. We need a fleet commander leading the offensive and an Alternus at his back defending. Both titles will be determined by the final tournament. Kor and Power straighten with excitement as Holmes says this, and Lee hunches in his seat, like the words press too heavily on him. In the wake of the sighting, I've begun to notice him as if a line connected us. I hear every word he utters, and even more, I hear his silences. Every word and every silence a tally on a ledger I despair of making, but know I must. Because time and space give me the coolness of resolve that shock did not. If it comes to a choice, I need to choose according to my conscience and my vows. Friendship will not justify treason. If Lee is compromised, it's my duty to report him. That night I lie awake, imagining Duck, unsheltered and exposed as he crosses the Medean Sea on Dragonback, and I think of Lee, the boy I know better than anyone, and at the same time have felt since the sighting, that I know not at all. I ache from missing them both. The following morning, our new life starts. Excused from class, we return to the Eyrie for intensive drilling of contact charges, weapons charges,
the quick and dirty ways to win when winning means a kill, not a kill shot. When you might not have the benefit of sparked dragonfire to do the job for you. Though a lack of demonstrated dragonfire at the sighting suggests that the other fleet is also unsparked, we must prepare as if they are. A steadiness settles over the eerie as Gorin tells us. This is how you open the throat. Not because he hasn't given us these kinds of lessons before, but because this is the first time we've listened and known an imminent reason we might use them. Lee sits silent, head bowed, elbows crooked over his knees as he listens to Gorin describe the ways to mutilate and kill an enemy rider. Enemy, Gorin says, not opponent. Even the language has changed. Lee's fingers are clenched on his knee so hard, the knuckles have gone white. And then we separate by squadrons, as we usually do, and the drilling begins. I rein Ayla away from Lee Sir Palor. Instead, I pair with Max, one of the Aurelian riders from my half-squadron. Lee, realizing what I've done, pairs off with Deirdre. It's the first time I've voluntarily chosen a sparring partner other than Lee in years. Usually, Gorin has to remind us to separate. Sparring starts. Ayla and I get in Max's guard once. Then again, and again, and again. Max made it into the 16th order, the upper half of the Corps flight ranking, but that's not enough.
Dragons, Annie! At least wait for the reset!
He mutters, massaging his arm where I've rammed him.
You asleep, Lee?
I hear Gorin shout from down on the eerie. Though I tried to claim a spot over the arena far from them, I can still see Lee and Deirdre sparring. Gorin's criticism wouldn't make sense for most riders. Lee is, after all, getting inside Deirdre's guard and landing hits. But I see the difference too. Lee isn't trying. He's doing the minimum. Enough in Lee's case to win, because in Lee's case, half-hearted is still good. Watching him, I feel my despair shift to anger. Gorin seems to be sharing my short temper.
Aurelian Squadron, time out! Annie, Lee, trade partners! Wake him up, Antigone!
It's always while I'm in the air that Gorin forgets to discount my ability. Palor and Ayla space out, 10 meters apart above the arena, wings spread to coast on the breeze. Lee and I eye each other through the slits in our visors, gripping blunt-headed jousting pikes and fireproof shields. We've practiced with both before, but because they're considered to be a complementary weapon to sparked dragonfire, they've never been a priority in our training. Now, with the threat of unsparked fleet engagements, they're the next best alternative. Ayla has begun to simmer with my anger herself. She is snorting, eager. Palor, like Lee, is just a little too calm, like he's not really there. Gorin calls the advance and we charge. Our momentum surpasses theirs. The force of our contact ripples through Lee Sir Palor. As they ride out the shock, I lean over Ayla's wing and ram my pike home. Lee moves his shield to block it, but not quite fast enough. It skids left and rams not into his chest, but his shoulder. Lee grunts in pain. He pulls Palor out to disengage, and as he does, I feel my anger bursting its restraints. Because I know what just happened. I have no illusions about my strength. Lee's and my abilities are level in traditional sparring, ash against ash, but when it comes to hand-to-hand combat, I'm half his size and have half his muscle. I should never have landed that penalty at all. We slam into each other again, and this time, despite an opening that I shouldn't have bared, Lee's pike doesn't make contact and mine does again.
Fight back, you bastard! Fight back, you bloody coward! Don't you leave me like this!
I feel the explosion of anger course from me into Ayla, at once a relief and an escalation into greater fury. We've spilled over. Through the haze, I hear Lee shouting, "You are out of order!" The world sharpens back into focus, though Ayla's and my shared anger still gives it a liquid edge. The echoes of the words I was thinking vibrate in my ears. That's how I realize I was doing more than thinking. Lee's ripped off his helmet, his eyes white-rimmed as he stares at me. Around us, other pairs have paused in their sparring. I can only imagine what they must be thinking if they heard what I shouted.
"They're a problem," Goran calls. "I'll take care of it," Lee says. "Ground, Antigone."
The sound of my full name at the end of his order snaps me back into my senses, even as the rage changes flavor. I yank Ayla's reins down and descend toward the deserted ramparts that gird the arena walls. We clatter onto the flagstones. I cut the straps that bind my legs to the stirrups and leap off. A moment later, Lee Serpallor lands beside us. He dismounts, every line of his movement tense with fury, and dismisses Palor back into the air with a flick of his wrist. We glare at each other. Behind me, Ayla, still riding my emotions, growls. Overhead, the Aurelian squad resumes sparring.
"What the hell was that?"
"I should report you. I should have reported you right then." Lee stands perfectly still. For a moment, all I can hear is the wind and Ayla's hard breathing at my back.
"Then why didn't you?"
My eyes are stinging.
"Because I wanted to trust you, and I was a fool for it."
I know my eyes must be too bright. Lee takes them in, then tilts his head back and looks up at the cirrus clouds high above us. When the silence has lengthened to the point that I'm on the verge of breaking it, he inhales slowly, pushes dark hair back from his eyes, and looks at me.
"You weren't."
"I wasn't?"
Lee shakes his head. And then, as his face fills with pain, I understand at last. The white knuckles, the silence, the bowed head. Lee isn't planning to defect. He's steeling himself to stay, as I should have known he would.
When he went to the closet on the third floor, to the stockpile to pack his bag for New Pythos, he realized that instead of escaping her, he had stumbled across her path. She was inside, the door closed, and she was crying. He'd heard her cry before, but he'd never heard her cry like this. Not like she was frightened or in pain, like she was in despair. He stood on the threshold and thought, "I can come back later, when she's gone." Because he knew that if he crossed the threshold now, he'd never leave. He would not get the backpack or the provisions. He wouldn't escape. He'd sink down beside her and do the only thing left to do. He would comfort her. He remembered his father's teachings and tried now to convince himself. She's just a peasant. She doesn't matter. But even as he told himself this, he found himself opening the door. She was sitting against the opposite wall, where he usually sat, her face buried in her knees, her hands gripping her hair. As if his body were acting of its own accord, he slid to the ground, placed his palms on the floor, and hung his head. He waited for her to say something, to demand an apology, and he thought of the words she would wring out of him. They didn't deserve it. He would say it. He would hate himself and her and his father for it. But he would say it. She'd won. But she didn't ask him to say anything. He heard floorboards creak as she shifted forward. And then he felt her hands reach out, clutch him, and pull him toward her. She buried her face against his shirt and held him like she thought he might disappear. Then she let out a dull sob, and he realized that he wasn't the only one who felt defeated. He wrapped his arms around her and began to utter phrases he'd never said before, only heard others say to him. "Don't cry. It's over now. I'm here." She was too thin. He could see the bruises the other children had left on her, and he felt responsible. The stockpile he'd come to pack was left unmentioned, unthought of, in the corner. He held her until she fell asleep, and when she woke, he took her to find food. He never spoke of the voyage to New Pythos again. She never asked him why he didn't. Though he didn't note it consciously, this was the first day he tried not to think of his family when they surfaced in his mind. He pushed them away, and only realized, months later, that he'd begun to forget them. Lee.
A day has passed since we spoke on the arena ramparts. Annie sits across from me in class with Atreus, so when the First Protector asks us to propose discussion topics and I raise my hand, I'm acutely aware of her eyes on me from across the table. And then I volunteer a topic I've never brought up in any class before. I ask about the old regime. Why is the new regime better than the old? My throat, closed from a long silence, has to unstick itself to speak. Atreus leans back in his chair, smiling mildly at the challenge.
Is it? He asks.
Of course it is, Kor says, as if even considering the alternative were offensive.
How?
The new regime has fair trials, Kor says. A trade-based economy that supports a growing middle class, universal education, opportunities for advancement that don't depend on birth. Compare that to the old regime. We've all heard the horror stories. Atreus nods slowly.
I'm sure you have. And some of you have even lived them.
Though the reference is oblique, I feel the room's awareness of Annie rise. I can practically see Kor making a point not to glance at her, while Power actually does. Her face reveals nothing.
These stories aside, Atreus goes on, what can you tell me about their failings?
This time, both Annie and I raise our hands. I've been conscious since the Fourth Order tournament of refraining from volunteering when Annie wants to participate. But today I keep my hand in the air and seek her eyes. They widen ever so slightly as they meet mine, her lips parting. I need this. She lowers her hand.
Lee?
I grip the edge of the table and speak slowly, working it through as I say it. Years' worth of readings and homework assignments and class discussions that can be distilled into a few sentences of difficult truth. Thousands died in poverty and starvation under the Triarchy. The Dragonborn feasted while their people starved and denied the famines they found inconvenient. They operated with almost no legal restraints, cruelly and without mercy, and then they justified the wrongs they committed by claiming it was their blood-born right. In my peripheral vision, Annie shifts in her chair. Atreus is nodding.
Indeed. And how could such unbridled power not ultimately lead to corruption? Can you see the flaw in it, Lee? The premise that lay rotten at the core?
I nod. This flaw I've been aware of since I first began to consider such things at all.
Their power was inherited.
Exactly.
Power did not correspond to worth. And that distance between power and worth is something Rule Under Dragons has been grappling with from the beginning.
Atreus indicates with an open hand the Aurelian cycle that remains on the table, ready to be referred to in every one of our classes.
There was greatness in them, but with that greatness came arrogance, and with that arrogance, corruption, and with that corruption, downfall. Now, how are you different?
Power's answer is ready, smug.
We deserve it.
The irony of his answer does not seem to be lost on Atreus, whose mouth has curved into a thin smile.
Do you?
Don't we?
That depends on you, Atreus says. You only deserve this mantle as long as you can be more reasonable and more virtuous than what came before. And that's important to remember now, more than ever, in the face of what may come.
When I look up, I find that Annie's two bright eyes haven't left my face. Tyndale keeps office hours in the literature department of the Lyceum. I find my way there quickly. I want to give him my refusal while the resolve is still hot.
because I know that when the answer from New Pythos comes back, these words will be harder to say, even though their answer can't change mine. I'll swallow this cup. What remains to be seen is how bitter it will be going down. Depending on the answer Chrissa and Duck bring back, it may turn out to be bitter indeed. I've thought about it, your offer, to join them. Yes? No. Tyndale grimaces, then motions toward the chair across from his paper-laden desk. The room is sun-soaked, the open window letting in the smell of mown grass from the courtyard. Sit. Aging leather upholstery creaks under my weight. Tyndale's tone becomes avuncular. He is, as before, speaking in dragon tongue. I worry that you haven't fully considered your situation, Leo. Perhaps this seems like the easiest answer right now, but in the long run, in your position, it will not be easy. Selling out now means paying the price later. I'm not selling out. Tyndale cocks his head. Then he rests it on a propped palm. Then what exactly are you doing? I'm choosing Kallipolis. I've switched to Dragon Tongue too. We are, after all, behind closed doors, and for this, I feel the need to use it. There is an exhilaration in speaking it again after all these years. It seems to lend the words power. I believe in Atreus. I believe in what he's doing, even if it was born in blood. Tyndale's expression has transformed from skepticism to pity. You think Palace Day was the end of the bloodshed? He asks. You've just chosen to start it all over again. 3 days later, Chrissa and Duck return from Iska, and I watch Annie fold Duck into the kind of hug she hasn't given me since we were children. Her smile is simple, easy, happy as she looks up at him. The kind of smile, carefree, unstained by old memories, that she's never given me. I turn away because I have no business feeling this sudden ache, and Chrissa hands me the message she bears from New Pythos. It was waiting for us. That's why she and Duck were able to return to Kallipolis so quickly. By the time our message reached them, the Pythian zone was already waiting for us in the embassy. The rightful triarchs of Kallipolis have tired of their exile. They will soon be coming home. The message is more or less the blow I was expecting, the cup to be drunk every bit as bitter and slow-acting as Tyndale had implied. Steeled against the shock, I feel still the clear pressure of purpose, the focus of a charted course, train, prepare, await the plunge. What I don't expect is the note, 2 weeks later, tucked inside the homework Tyndale hands back to me, in the well-worn script